Today, we're going to talk about investing passively in 2023, and we're going to give you the guide to do that with a man who's been doing it for a while, Mr. Travis Watts. Ladies and gentlemen, Travis Watts. Travis, how are you, sir?
Hey, doing great, man. Thanks so much for the invite. Thrilled to be here.
Man, it's my pleasure to have you. I know you've been playing this game for a while. You're doing real estate just for a long time in general, as well as investor education with Ashcroft Capital, who's this huge capital team who does a lot of real estate investing, over $1.7 billion, I think it is at this point. Tell the listeners something. Just give a little bit of your background more in depth, please, if you could.
Sure. Yeah, we're actually at $2.5 billion at this point. So
let's go.
I know, man. Keep adding those bees. Yeah, cool. So my background, you know, I'll put it to you this way. I started with kind of planting the seeds of wanting to be an investor from a pretty young age. I would say about high school timeframe. Was introduced to, you know, the way a lot of people get introduced into this stuff through Rich Dad, Poor Dad and Robert Kiyosaki's books and things like that. And, you know, I jumped in 2009 with single family homes, and my mindset was completely different than it is today, and specifically over the last 8 years, I had a buy low and sell high mentality. So what I thought investing meant was you either buy a stock at $10 and hope it goes to 20. And if it does, you sell it, or you fix and flip a house, or you day trade stocks. Like, it always had to be active and you always had to be involved. And so I did a lot of that stuff early on to kind of build up some capital, which taught me a lot, thankfully, about real estate in general. And then as I started segueing into vacation rentals and more of these buy and hold single family homes, I started realizing the power of passive income and the power of cash flow, specifically within real estate. And so in 2015 and 16 is when I finally got to the point of doing real estate syndications or private placements, which is about roughly 80% of my portfolio today, spread out across multifamily and self-storage and car washes and mobile home parks and things like that. So that came from a couple mentors who had sold their companies in the mid-1990s and had started this real estate group out in Colorado. And they were the first mentors, professional mentors of mine, who were willing to just, you know, open up to me and just freely share, not try to upsell me on some program or course or book, but just say, hey, this is what we do full time. And this has kind of been our experience with it. And man, it couldn't have come at a better time. I was coming out of the W-2 world, working 98 hours per week, 14-hour days. I worked in oil and gas. I was overseas. I was out of state. I was never home. I just didn't really have a life outside of work. And I was looking for a way to get more hands-off with investing. And so what I teach people today is just passive income in general. Of course, a lot of my conversations are about multifamily and Ashcroft Capital and stuff like that. But I don't care how you do it, man. It doesn't matter if you're investing in ATM machines or hard money lending or dividend paying stocks. I don't care. The idea is to build financial independence through passive income. And it's not usually what you and I were taught or what your listeners were taught when, you know, you come up in the world learning about 401ks and IRAs. And this is all the buy low, sell high. It's shove your money over here, hand it over to Wall Street. And when you're in your 60s or 70s, hopefully you have enough. And if you don't, oh well. So I started thinking about, well, you know, screw that. I don't want to wait till 60s or 70s, number one. And I want to be able to enhance my lifestyle currently at whatever age. I did it through my 20s. Now I'm into my 30s and moving into my 40s. I want to have freedom and flexibility and, you know, what I call time freedom, the ability to do what you want, when you want, as much as you want with your time. That really can only be truly accomplished through passive income, in my opinion. And that's why I think it's so powerful. I've got to see it firsthand what kind of impact that can make. So yeah, that's kind of how the journey went from, you know, humble beginnings to where we are today.
Nice. So from humble to absolute beast when it comes to passive investing. So let me ask you this then, Travis. With your passive investing philosophy, how did you create what it is now? How did you come to the acclimation point where you seem to have it really tuned, fine-tuned on what you're looking for passively? How'd you do that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the first time I really sat down to, you know, look at a real financial statement and really evaluate net worth and realize how much money would it really take, honestly and conservatively, to live on, right? So everybody's numbers are different. I knew what my number would be based on kind of what I was living on at that time and what my salary was. And so when I thought to myself, what if I sold off all these single family homes and these vacation rentals and these flips and these buy and holds and all this stuff, even the house that I was living in. I said, what if I sold it all and I paid the taxes and I paid the realtor fees and I went completely liquid? What conservative cash would I have in my bank account? From there, I said, okay, I was learning about these syndications. And I said, at the time, remembering this is 2015 and 2016, it was not uncommon. In fact, it was pretty conservative to get into a deal that gave you about an 8% annualized cash flow in year number one. And from there, it would just go up to 9 and then 10 and then 11 as you can raise rents and get through a business plan. So I created what I call the 8% rule. And it's how do you live on 8% of any form of passive income annualized? So the numbers would work like this. $1.25 million invested at 8% is $100,000. So you can kind of use that as a metric. Now, you could use different percentages and say, well, I want to be ultra conservative and I want to invest in bonds or something like that at 4%. Okay, 2.5 million at 4% is 100,000. Or you could say, hey, I think I can do better and I could do 10%. Well, cool. 1 million at 10% is 100,000 per year. So that was kind of my, you know, beginning philosophy, if you will. And from there, it was just about diversifying and learning about different asset classes. And usually when you're getting a higher yield, you may not have as much equity upside on the back end, if any. And sometimes if you have lower cash flow, you might have an equity pop like on a value add multifamily deal. So, you know, I don't project, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you when I'm looking at all these deals and they're saying, you know, 18% IRR in 3 to 5 years. I don't know, man. I don't buy it. I don't really care. It's just, does it cash flow today? Is that a conservative cash flow? Does it meet my objectives? And is it likely to increase over time? And if the equity happens to be there, that's fantastic. And historically, it usually has been, but I don't bank on it. So that's just how I look at the world is number one, it's a cash flow focus. Number two would be any kind of equity upside. Because I've learned through, you know, the flips and my own experience and other family members losing tons of money that nobody has the crystal ball. Nobody does know what stock's going to go up or down or what the market's going to do. And so you're kind of the thing that's more stable, consistent, and predictable is passive income, depending on which asset class we're talking about.
I like it. So let me ask, then with you and all the stuff that you passively, you talk a lot about just the passive income piece of it. And I've seen your videos as well. You talk about the difference between the active income and passive income. To you, what's the right word? I'm gonna have to edit this out because I can't remember what the right word is. What what identifies the difference in one and the other in like a very short kind of maybe like a sentence more than anything else? Because I feel like it's sometimes difficult for people to understand what's the true difference of the two.
Yeah, and I appreciate you breaking it down that way. So in one sentence, I would say having an active involvement in the business makes you an active investor. Okay. So when I fix and flip the house, I was doing that. I found the deal. I underwrote the deal. I coordinated the teams. Not that I had to do all the work myself. I had contractors and, you know, construction teams and things like that. But I was very actively involved, right? So a passive investor is someone who does not materially participate in the actual business plan. So I'm just a hands-off investor. When I do a syndication, the general partners are finding the deals, they're underwriting the deals, they're raising capital for the deals, they're the asset manager, they might be the property manager, or they might hire property managers. So all I'm doing is saying, I like that deal, I like that market, right. I like you as a team, here's $100,000 and I want to partner with you in that deal and just send me the monthly checks. You know, and so there's pros and cons, you know, and what I always say is if you're going to be an active investor, and I'm not anti-active, I spent 6.5 years doing it. There's a lot of reasons to do it if that's your thing. But for me, it wasn't my passion. It wasn't my skill set. It was a headache. It was a hassle. It just wasn't the right fit for me. I wasn't a handyman. I didn't have connections. I didn't come from a real estate background. So I was just a bunch of trial and error. And what I tell people is you should technically have a higher return if you're going to be an active investor. Otherwise, you're kind of wasting your time. What are you doing? You know, if you could get a passive return that's the same, then why do the work? So that's a way to look at it. I made a video a couple of years ago about an active deal with a 15% annualized return and a passive deal at 10%. I'd rather be passive because when you actually calculate the dollars involved in your time, a lot of people don't realize they might be working for $20 an hour being an active investor. Worth considering.
Yeah, that's true. Now, you did talk a little bit earlier about, and I want to go back just a little bit. You talked about, you know, a lot of investors that have lost money. And regardless of what we'd like to think, that's a part of the game in losing money. But with passive investing, 100%. How do you mitigate that risk? What's your thought process on that?
Yeah, I would say, so again, mostly what I do, about 80% are these syndications where I'm a limited partner and I'm partnering up with general partners to do the business plan. So in that circumstance, you have kind of three areas of risk. You have the operator themselves, and that's their track record, their ability to execute the business plan properly, do what they say they're going to do, remain conservative, make good decisions, all that kind of stuff. To me, that's about 50% of the whole equation and, you know, to have a likely outcome of success. The second item is the market, and markets are very important. You've got to look at where people are moving, where companies are moving to, what kind of diversifications in that particular market as far as employment. You got to look at crime stats and school ratings and average incomes. There's a lot of metrics about markets. About 25% of the equation in terms of risk, in my opinion. And the third is the deal itself. And that's where a lot of newer investors get caught up, is they're only looking at the deal and they're trying to figure out, is that a property that's a good property to put my money into? Forgetting right. about, can this team actually execute the business plan or not? Because, you know, a bad operator can ruin a really good deal really fast. And I've seen that happen. So the only thing I've ever come up with for an ultimate strategy, and it's not foolproof, but it's to diversify. It's to be in different markets, different asset classes with different operators and, you know, different pools of income. Like I mentioned before, I do some publicly traded REITs and hard money notes and ATM machines and other unrelated, uncorrelated assets to just the broader market. And, you know, I always think to your point of risk, and a lot of people, and myself included, when I first got started, was a little skeptical thinking about scams and, you know, the Bernie Madoff stories and stuff. And the reality is, before that guy, you know, folded under and got caught, Bernie Madoff is who we're talking about, you could have ran a background check on him. You could have asked for referrals and references. The guy was a public figure. He was like a chairman or something on the NASDAQ. He, you know, a very credible company, a physical presence. His own kids worked in the company, had no history of fraud. And then boom, you know, you would have been wrong. And so all I can think is, you know, the investors that really got crushed by that scenario were the ones that went way too hard and heavy. They're the 100 million net worth people that put 95% with him. And those who put 100K having a 10 million net worth were not that heavily impacted. So that's how I look at it from a risk perspective as well.
I like it. So, all right, you talked about REITs, and this is new for me. I'm just starting to learn about REITs. I'm just kind of relatively new to the REIT game. So these questions are going to be very simple, and you're going to educate me as well. When looking at REITs, what are you looking at? And what's, like, when you go and say, all right, I'm going to go for this REIT, what are you looking to break that down? Is it the same process as when you're looking at a GP or a deal?
All right, let me explain it this way. So a REIT, for anybody listening, is a real estate investment trust. They have to abide by their own rules and laws. I think it's something like whatever profit they have, like positive cash flow available, they have to distribute a minimum of 90% to their investors. So they're usually high dividend paying publicly traded REITs. Now, a REIT can also be a private company as well, but we're going to talk about the publicly traded ones that I was referring to when I mentioned them. So here's, let me paint this example for your listeners. So when we talk about correlation, we're talking about an asset and its correlation to the broader index market, like the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, the NASDAQ. We're talking about just widely spread out market indexes. If you have a one correlation, let's say, you know, private real estate compared to the broader stock market, a one would mean if the stock market goes up 2%, the private real estate goes up 2%. And if the stock market falls 5%, the private real estate falls 5%. It's an exact synchronization. If you have a zero correlation in the middle of the spectrum, it means you really don't have a correlation. Stocks could be up, real estate could be down. There's no rhyme or reason. They operate independent of one another. And if you have negative one correlation, it means that the two that you're comparing move in exact opposite directions. So if real estate goes up 3%, the stock market would move down 3%. Okay. So with that in mind, private real estate compared to the broad stock market has a 0.14 correlation. So a very low correlation. Publicly traded REITs that are in the stock market have a 0.65 correlation to the broader index. So what that means and why that's relevant to understand is when you have a year like 2022, where the broader indexes are down 20, 30, some of them were even like 40% down, depending on smaller sectors and things, they dragged the REIT prices down as well, regardless of how the actual assets are performing. I mean, that obviously plays a factor long term in the fundamentals of the company in the REIT. But in the short run, when people are hitting the sell button, they're selling everything. You got a lot of institutions out there that are just selling and selling and selling. And so what happens is there's a REIT that I invested in this year, and I'll tell you what the example was. I was not interested in buying it in January before the interest rates started going up. And the reason was that the yield annualized was only about 6%, and it was trading at an all-time high valuation. Mm-hmm. What happened is as the markets went down and corrected, that REIT went almost 50% down. And what that meant is that their cash flow, because the underlying performance didn't really change that much, doubled. So now instead of a 6% return, you're looking at a 12% annualized cash flow return. Now, there's always a risk in the fact that they could cut their distribution down temporarily or permanently, but I know that I'm buying it at about 50% off from its value less than a year ago. And I know that I'm now getting a double digit passive income yield where it was only 6 just a few months ago. Right. So that's when I jump in the market and I buy REITs. I cannot time the market, nor do I try to. It's just when I happen to log in to my brokerage account and see a scenario like that, I dive into it, you know? So I'm not a genius and not everything I buy is stellar and amazing, but I'd rather buy something at 50% off than at an all-time high. Let's put it that way.
That makes sense. It's still no crystal ball, like you said earlier. Crystal ball is really elusive, so I get it.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. So, all right, so let's get to the meat and potatoes. Let's talk about 2023. And like you said, you don't have a crystal ball. It's not something that anybody should be thinking, hey, this is the way I'm going to do it. This is the exact way. This advice is just something that Travis is looking at and how he was thinking about it. And hopefully it'll be something to kick your thought process into gear too. So for you, Travis, what's your thought process as we're getting into the tail end of 2022, heading into 2023 when it comes to passive investing?
Right. And so it's a great question. It's on everybody's minds. And when you have inflation as high as it's been, you know, at 7, 8, 9% year over year inflation, that means if you just keep money in your bank or under your mattress, you're losing that much every year in purchasing power. Right. So I'm not of the mindset that I'm going to wait and see. I'm just going to hoard cash for the next few years and hope for a big meltdown that may or may not happen. Because of your point, I don't have a crystal ball. What I am is a long-term and focused investor. And for anybody who's, let's say that you're a stock investor long-term and you're one of those index fund investors, I'll just buy the S&P until the day I die. Well, if you can start buying at a discount, then you're going to double down on that. It's called buying the dip. It's called dollar cost averaging. And so that's what I'm doing in both the public and the private sector right now, because as interest rates have more than doubled over the past year, we're finally starting to see commercial real estate discount their pricing. Because it always, you know, real estate's way slower moving than the public markets. So the deal that, like, we're closing, for example, at Ashcroft, the tail end of this year here, is being purchased at about a 20% discount relative to pricing 1 year ago. So to me, it's an opportunity to buy the dip. And as long as that deal is going to continue cash flowing, and as long as we have adequate debt service and we have interest rate caps or fixed rate debt for a longer term than how long we anticipate holding for, and no kind of bridge loans and stuff like that, I'm a fan, you know, and I'm all in. And so I did deals throughout 2020 when everyone was scared to death. I did a ton of deals in 2021. I did probably 7 deals in 2022. And I anticipate I'll probably do about the same in 2023 with more of an emphasis on due diligence, the type of debt people are putting on the real estate, and probably just continuing to double down with the top operators that I've had personal experience with that have truly underpromised and over-delivered, historically speaking. So I am kind of pulling back in that sense, but I'm not, you know, giving up. I'm not on the sidelines, things like that. So I'll share a funny story with you. in 2015, I reached out to who I thought was probably the number one or the biggest syndicator out there in the space, right? It's one who I really admired and looked up to, and I just wanted to pick his brain like we're doing right now. And I said, man, I really want to get in these syndications. Can you put me on your deal list? I want to partner with you in a deal. And he goes, oh, Travis, he goes, man, he goes, you mark my words, 2016, next year, is going to be one of the biggest market meltdowns we've seen in our lifetime. And we are not doing any deals right now. And it scared me to death. And, you know, because I held that guy on such a high pedestal. But the point is, just like today, I didn't subscribe to that philosophy of I'm going to sit on the sidelines and hope that maybe a market does A, B, or C, because nobody knows what the Fed's going to do and the government's going to do and interest rates and the whole deal. So I continued investing, and I did get involved with a lot of different private placements, and over about a 5-year period, roughly speaking, doubled my entire portfolio size. You know, meanwhile, he had done like one, maybe two deals throughout that whole 5-year period. And I'm not saying I'm smarter than that guy by any means, but you have to subscribe to your own philosophy. What makes sense to you? And, you know, I have more of a regret almost of not trying something out than, you know, waiting on the sidelines and the market just keeps moving higher without me, you know, than it shoulda, coulda, woulda. Best time to get in real estate was what, 50 years ago? Next best time is today, absolutely, as they say.
Right now. All right. So, Travis, I've got another question for you. Of course, it's a podcast, Oliver. Why would you not have another question? So the question for you, Travis, is this. With all the stuff that you do, you've had a lot of lessons. And I, just personally, I found that early on in my investing career, figuring things out, it's very difficult sometimes to identify what your key skill is. In yours, I seem to see on not just the passive investing side, you do really well when it comes to analysis and paying attention, as well as you're able to articulate it so somebody can understand it. How did you discover what your skill is? Well, what would you say your skill is? And then how did you discover that skill?
That's a great question. Unique perspective on that. So as far back as high school, again, my senior year of high school, I wrote a book, and I wrote this, but it was like a 60-page book, and it was like a self-published thing, you know, but I did this out of my own initiative.
I love it.
And not because it was a school project and not because someone told me to, not because I was trying to make money or get famous. I did this. It was called How to Achieve a 4.0 GPA with Minimal Effort, something like that, in high school. It was a really long, drawn out, goofy title. And I wrote it because kids in my school were really struggling. I went to like a C-minus rated school, and I found some strategies and some tips and tricks that I thought were useful in sharing on a broader scale than trying to meet with people one-on-one and do mentoring and stuff. So I wanted to help them out from an early age and help educate in some form or fashion, just try to help other people out with things that had already helped me. And so that carried forward. I wrote another book later, about 5-6 years after that. And then just got into, you know, posting stuff on YouTube and Instagram. And, you know, I don't have courses. I don't have books. I don't do professional mentoring. I give my time away to people for free in 15-minute intervals. I write a ton of blogs, a lot of articles. I do numerous segments on numerous different podcasts and webinars and all this kind of stuff to just get the word out to people about what it is we're talking about and what the real power of passive income can be for you. And so here's what I always say. Try to get to a point in your life where whatever you do actively is something you really care about. It's something that you're really interested in learning for your own creativity and self-development and fulfillment. And for some people, that's charity. And for others, it's something else. And some people like me back in the day, you know, just want to work part-time. You know, it's not like they hate their career. Like maybe they're an engineer. It's what they went to school for and or a physician. But instead of working 80 hours a week, they would prefer to work 40 hours per week. And so passive income can allow you to do that, you know, with enough time, effort, and self-discipline put in. So passive income allows you to spend more time on the things you love and outsource the things that you don't.
That is, I'm going to have to write that down and add that to my memoirs later. All right. Thanks, Travis. I'll give you some 10% on that one. All right. So, Travis, here's another question for you. What is your, up to this point, you have done a lot of deals. What has been your favorite deal so far?
Yeah, favorite deal is when you go in with the expectation that you're going to maybe be invested for about 5 years. And if you're lucky and things go according to plan, you're going to double your investment in the syndication space. Well, I had a deal years ago, about 2016, I went into as a limited partner, 5-year underwriting, anticipated a double of your money. We sold in something like 18 months and almost doubled our money that quickly. So what that allowed me to do is cut years off of, you know, the compounding curve and then take the money early and reinvest it. And I pretty much got two deals in the same 5-year time frame, which propelled the portfolio a lot, you know, accelerated it a lot more quickly. So that's something we saw a lot from when I started doing this up until about 2021, early 2022. And now that interest rates are coming up, I anticipate we're going to see a lot less of that. And we're going to see the opposite, which is people saying 5-year hold, and they end up holding it for 7 years or something like that. So markets always change and evolve. But, you know, I'm a big fan of what multifamily has done through every bear market cycle. When you look back at all recessions considered, and even one of the worst, 2008 through 2010, multifamily Class B rents, which is like pre-existing 1980s, 1990s built, you know, product, they dropped about $125 a month in rent. And so when we're buying a deal today, we're usually picking it up at about 200 below market rents already. And we're doing a value add plan, which is renovating units, clubhouse, amenities, et cetera, so we can justify the rent bumps. In addition to inflation running really high, which is helping justify the rent bumps on top of that. So if we can just get through half a business plan, we should be sitting on somewhat of a cushion to withstand some further turmoil, higher interest rates, or a nasty recession like we saw previously. So, you know, there was less than a 1% default on the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac multifamily loans through the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And we all know what happened to single family homes and how many people lost their primary residence. So again, I'm just a fan of looking at history and analyzing the stats and facts and having a little comfort that sometimes you're going to double your money early and other times you're going to hold longer than expected. And some deals may cash flow less than what you want. But if you're in it for the long haul, you can probably average a pretty healthy return over the long term.
I love it. You, when you're spitting out that information, all I saw was the double the dollar signs just compounding and pounding and pounding. And it's really interesting just the market we're in and how crazy it seems to be. But the thought process behind that to get to where you want to go is absolutely amazing. For you, you've been educating investors for, like we said, a long time. You are the investor educator with Ashcroft Capital. For those who come to you with their first time investing, let's say they're accredited already, they got their 50K, what is the most common misconception that they have?
Ooh, that's a good one. It'd probably be what I mentioned previously, which is looking too heavily at the deal itself and trying to get caught up in analysis by paralysis and trying to understand all the complex underwriting that the team does and looking at the T12 or the trailing 12, which is all the income and expenses from the previous ownership, and just trying to base their decision fully off of that and try to interpret data that frankly takes years and years to really get good at interpreting, right? And so again, it's kind of like the beauty of being a limited partner is a lot of people are not even real estate people. They're a doctor, they're a dentist, they're a lawyer, they're an attorney, they're an engineer, they're a business owner. They're out there doing their thing professionally at their highest and best potential. And they're just diversifying some of their portfolio outside the stock market or into real estate for the tax benefits and for the cash flow and stuff like that. So I would say that's probably number one. Number two is just those who subscribe to the mentality that I don't subscribe to, which is, hey, you know, I'm seeing all these scary headlines and I'm just going to wait and see. And I mean, wait and see can last for decades. I mean, people that are sitting on the sidelines have missed out on so many great opportunities over the years. And I think most of us listening probably know, but most people who have gotten exceptionally wealthy got wealthy during a recession. You know, when things start falling apart and breaking, that's discounts. And when you pick things up at discounts, like I know Warren Buffett picked up all those shares of Coca-Cola back on, was it Black Monday or something, in the stock market in the 80s, you know, for cents on the dollar. He's never sold them. And so his annualized cash flow is like 60% or something, you know, on his basis in those shares. So, you know, that's how you play the game. You don't get scared and say, oh, I'm going to sell my Coca-Cola shares because they're down 50%. That's when you get in. It's the opposite thinking to what your emotions want you to do.
That's absolutely true. That is absolutely true. Every time I've seen, and even with the books that I read, as you, well, you can't see, but if you look here, there's a bunch of books. And many of those books,
nice,
I appreciate that. So the investor and the people who are writing them, or the Robert Kiyosaki's and the, God rest his soul, the Steve Jobs and, you know, these big names,
yep,
they were all investing or doing something in a time where it was less, or they found a problem to answer. And even then, it just compounds, yeah, and compounds and compounds. It's really amazing. So let's talk about the troop to task. And for those who are listening and watching, a troop to task is a military term. In the military, we give a soldier or sailor or seaman or Marine or Coast Guard member a job to do. Their boss comes to them and says, hey, Johnny, I want you to go down the street and I want you to come back and here's your mission. For you, Travis, what's your troop to task for the listener right now to improve their passive income strategies?
I would start by doing this, and very few people do this. I would do two things real quick. I would set in writing and or with your spouse or partner or somebody, your goals, like your real financial goals. Like what are you doing? Why would you invest? Why even invest at all? Right? Usually we're trying to get to some outcome, whether it's putting your kids through college, retiring by age 50, having a 5 million net worth, having 10,000 a month passive income. Figure out what you're doing and why, and really be able to articulate that to other people. I think that's probably the most important. And then figure out what kind of investment would be appropriate to get you to those goals. So I'll give you two quick examples. So you have Sally over here that says, I want 10,000 a month passive income so I can move to part-time work instead of full-time. You have John over here that says, I need a $5 million nest egg by the time I retire so I have safety and adequate income and cash reserves. Well, for Sally, she's gonna look for something that produces passive income, ideally on a monthly basis, to try to hit that objective. Whereas John may say, I don't really care about passive income. I might do a new development project or something in real estate that doesn't cash flow, but it has a nice projected return after 5 years, right, and I'm 15 years out from retirement. So, you know, it is what it is. I'll do it in my IRA or something like that. So it's aligning investments and understanding what investments exist out there. And not many people realize how many passive income investments really are out there. I mean, even every year I'm still learning too. I hear about new things I had no idea about every year. And then, you know, you tie it to something emotionally. When we talk about goals, don't just say 10,000 a month, 5 million net worth. Tie it to something emotionally, you know, tie it to your family, tie it to your kids, make yourself accountable for it, because you're not going to give up on your family. You know what I mean? But you might give up a financial goal. If you said 5 mil and then we hit a nasty recession and you lose half your net worth, you might say, well, maybe I'll just do 2.5 million then instead. And so it's a lot easier to give up on those kinds of goals. So keep that in mind.
That is fantastic advice. I've never thought about that. I actually wrote that down. I'm going to have to re-go over my goals and add some emotional aspects to it to improve them. All right. So now, Travis, we're going to get into the hot seat.
I want to ask you a bunch of questions. And I want to have them answered immediately.
All right. Yes, we have sound effects here on the Oliver Perry Show. All right. So, all right, Travis. So I'm going to ask you 5 questions. We're going to need them to answer honestly and immediately. First question. Okay. What song always makes you sing along?
Oh, gosh. There's so many. I'm such a music guy, man. I drum. I was in so many bands before. Oh, my God. You're So Last Summer by a band called Taking Back Sunday. I was into that kind of indie rock stuff. So that's one of my favorites.
So I'm going to give you an answer too. On each of these, I'm going to give my answer as well. And for me, I've been on this Death From Above 1976 kick, and they've got a song called Trainwreck, and I don't know what it is, but I love that song. So anytime that song comes on, I'll play it like a good 10 times before I finish listening to it. So that's nice. That's me. That's me. So that, don't feel bad. I think that's a good choice. That's absolutely a good choice. All right. So next question. All right. What is something that you wish you never found out about?
Oh my gosh. Something I wish I never found out about. Well, okay. So, you know, the housing market's been pretty crazy, right? And right. So we Just coincidental timing. We were renting for years in order to invest the maximum amount of capital into projects. We were homeowners before. We just sold our house to be able to invest. So in 2021, last year, we bought a home. And thankfully, interest rates were still low, but houses were literally at the peak. I knew that, you know, or I thought that would be the case. So we had to throw down hard money on our house with sight unseen, bought it out of state and had no inspection whatsoever. And of course, upon moving in, it was, you know, termites and cockroaches and mold issues and water lines breaking. And so we were in for a lot more of a rehab than what we had hoped for. So I wish I never had known that.
Okay. No, I get it. Mine's is not nearly as real estate related. I was once in Japan. I was deployed in Japan in support of an operation after Tamagotchi had happened, the flood that hit Japan. And I walked into a 7-Eleven one day and they had these melon cream sodas. Travis, I swear to everything on God's green earth, what I wouldn't give to have one of those right now. That thing, oh my God, it tasted so good. And since that time, I have been trying to find them here stateside and have not found them. It drives me nuts. I don't even want to talk about it anymore than I did talk about it. Let's let's go on to the next question. Huh? All right. Here's the question. What can someone do to make you gain respect immediately?
I would say listen to people, you know, two ears, one mouth, right? Listen twice as much as you speak. Give people fair opportunity to be heard. I think a lot of people want to jump in and just talk about themselves, and which makes these podcasts difficult and awkward for even me, because it's really not my go-to. When I'm at a networking event, I'm not going around telling my story to people. Right. I'm only asking other people questions about themselves. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, everyone wants to be seen, heard, and understood. So that's a good lesson to embrace.
I like it. For you listening, I will give you this. This is mine, and this is my go-to. Try, attempt, take your shot. In my household, we don't say try normally, but in this instance, you have to. You'd be surprised how many people are excited to talk to you once you said, yes, I did this, and it just failed. It flopped. Or, hey, I put forth the effort, and I called 17 brokers this weekend. Because now the person who you're talking to, particularly in the multifamily space, they see you're at least making the attempt, and you're trying to figure it out. And that can mean bouncing away more than the guy who just comes to you and just says, hey, you should tell me this, this, and this. Nobody wants to hear that. Get out of here. Maybe that last part was too aggressive. I'm sorry. All right, so next, Jesus, next question. What is the top of your bucket list? What is at the top of your bucket list? I'm sorry.
Ooh. What's at the top of my... So yep. When the pandemic came on, so my wife and I, we love international travel. And okay. So we had to cancel a bunch of trips. One that we were really looking forward to was going to Bali. That was our next trip in line. And then we're going to head to Costa Rica. So that's still on our bucket list. We had our firstborn about a year ago. So that's kind of slowed down our travel even more. But... yeah, we're going to get to those trips as soon as we can. So
I love it. I love it. Congratulations on a new one, even though it's been a year. I'm a little bit late, but congratulations nonetheless. Being a father's dope.
thanks, man.
For me, I want to learn to rally car drive. I don't know why. I obviously have mental issues, but I just want to learn to rally car drive. For some reason, I want to go to the woods in Norway and just swing the back of a car into a tree. Don't ask me. I don't know. I got problems.
That's dangerous, man. Come on, yes. You gotta live for something.
Yes, yeah. I don't know, Travis. I don't know. Maybe I'll just have like a video game and just do that and crash that into a tree. Maybe that'll satisfy the hungry. All right.
I think bungee jumping is probably a safer bet. So
yeah. You're probably right. You're probably right. All right. Next question, Travis. What is the hardest word for you to say?
Oh gosh, Massachusetts. I always mess that one up. Massachusetts. I cannot say it fast. I have to, and I always sound like I'm really slow when I'm saying it. I'm like Massachusetts. So I hate that word. That's such a dumb state name.
No, I'm behind you 100%. Mine is stamina. I can never get this one right the first time.
Stamina.
It's always stamina. I'll say stamina. I don't know. I just, I don't know what it is about that word. It drives me nuts. But all right, Travis, man, thank you so much for coming on. I hope you had a great time. For those listening, I hope you had a great time. You learned something today. Make sure you go check Travis out. And matter of fact, I'm going to let Travis give you how you can reach out and get in touch with him. Travis, it's on you.
Yeah, man. Instagram and Facebook is at Passive Investor Tips. That's also the name of my podcast. You can look that up on YouTube. And Travis Watts is my name if you want to connect on LinkedIn or Bigger Pockets. If you want to hop on my calendar and can't find them there for whatever reason, ashcroftcapital.com/Travis. Happy to hop on a Q&A with you. No matter who you are, no matter what age you are, no matter if you're accredited or not, if you want to learn more about passive income, happy to help out.
I love it. Ladies and gentlemen, remember, you're better than you were, but you're not half as good as you're going to be. We'll see you next time.